Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg from the Allstate Studios in Chicago on 720 WGN.
I said in the pre-introduction to this program that we're going to talk about the Middle East, and indeed we will. But that also means talking about the United States and its involvement in the Middle East. I should tell you first who our guests are. One is an old and treasured friend who's here rather often, Charles Lipson, who is, of course, a leading professor at the University of Chicago in the Department of Political Science, and a much-published author, books, articles, and also a great activist on campus, protesting at times about some aspects of administrative policy. Our other guest is Laith Al-Saud, who's with us for the first time. He teaches Islamic World Studies at DePaul University, even as he is finishing his own doctorate at the University of Chicago. Gentlemen, I'm going to do a rare thing that I have not done, I think, in many years. I'm going to start by reading you a column to which I then want your response. But first, you better say hello to prove that you're here. Laith, are you here?
Thanks for having me.
My great pleasure.
I'm delighted to be here, Milt, and I'm delighted to have my first chance to have a conversation with Laith.
By the way, I must ask you, I know that you're born in Baghdad, but your family came when you were just a kid.
Sure.
You were raised in Indiana, I think you told me.
Yes.
The name Al-Saud, does that mean you're a member of the Royal House of Arabia?
No, I'm not.
How do you come by that name?
It's a name in which there's some tribal affiliations, but when you're talking about thousands and thousands of members with loose tribal affiliations over many, many generations, it's somewhat dispersed and distilled. There is no relation with me and the royal family.
But you'd get some special attention if you went to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. Are you saying that when you were a young man going to bars, you never said when you, Al-Saud and some good-looking girl would you wouldn't just say, well, we don't talk about that.
I can assure you that there's nothing good that comes out of the name Al-Saud in the last 10 years of this country. So.
No, I said I wanted to read you a column. This is Krautheimer. About a week ago, but this I only found it today. Somebody called my attention to it. So, I launch. Either Israel is engaged in the most elaborate ruse since the Trojan horse, or it is on the cusp of a preemptive strike on Iran's nuclear facilities. What's alarming is not just Iran's increasing store of uranium or the growing sophistication of its rocketry. It is also increasingly menacing. It's also the increasingly menacing annihilationist threats emanating from Iran's leaders. Israel's existence is, quote, an insult to all humanity, says President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Anyone who loves freedom and justice must strive for the annihilation of the Zionist regime, explains the country's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Israel is, quote, a true cancer tumor on this region that should be cut off. Everybody wants to avoid military action, surely the Israelis above all. They can expect a massive counterattack from Iran. 50,000 rockets launched from Lebanon, Islamic Jihad firing from Gaza, and worldwide terror against Jewish and Israeli targets. Yet, Israel will not sit idly by in the face of the most virulent genocidal threats since Nazi Germany. The result, then, was 6 million murdered Jews. There are 6 million living in Israel today. Time is short. Last-ditch negotiations in Istanbul, Baghdad, and Moscow have failed abjectly. The Iranians are contemptuously playing with the process. The strategy is delay until they get the bomb. What to do? The sagest advice comes from Anthony Cordesman, sometime guest on this program, in fact,
Scholar on these matters.
Yes, a military guy who's now a big think tank person, has been for years. So, again, the sagest advice comes from Anthony Cordesman, military analyst at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, hard-headed realist, and a believer that, quote, multilateralism and soft power must still be the rule and not the exception. He may have found his exception. Quote, there are times when the best way to prevent war is to clearly communicate that it is possible, he argues. Today, the threat of a U.S. attack is not taken seriously. Not by the region, not by Iran, not by the Israelis, who therefore increasingly feel forced to act before Israel's more limited munitions, far less powerful and effective than those in the U.S. arsenal, can no longer penetrate Iran's ever-hardening facilities. Cordesman therefore proposes threefold action, One, clear U.S. red lines. It's time to end the ambiguity about American intentions. Establish real limits on negotiations to convince Iran that the only alternative to a deal is preemptive strikes and to convince Israel to stay its hand. Two, make it clear to Iran that it has no successful options. Either their program must be abandoned in a negotiated deal, see number one above, on generous terms for the West, see number three below, or their facilities will be physically destroyed. Three, give Iran a face-saving way out. Offer Iran the most generous possible terms, economic, diplomatic, and political. End of sanctions, assistance in economic and energy development, trade incentives, and a regional security architecture. Would Iran believe a Cordesman-like ultimatum? Given the record of the Obama administration, maybe not. Some, though not Cordesman, have therefore suggested the further step of requesting congressional authorization for the use of force if Iran does not negotiate towards denuclearization. First, that's the right way to do it. No serious military action should be taken without congressional approval, contra Libya. Second, Iran might actually respond to a threat backed by a strong bipartisan majority of the American people, thus avoiding both war and the other nightmare scenario, a nuclear Iran. All options are bad. Doing nothing is worse. The status quo may not prevent some form of war, concludes Cordesman, and may even be making it more likely. Now, that's a fascinating contribution. Obviously, Cordesman has influenced and inspired this piece by Krauthammer, but Krauthammer is a second-level hawk in this, and he's saying Israel will have to go it alone to destroy the nuclear possibilities in Iran, but the way to clear the action for them is to get congressional authorization, not presidential authorization. I apologize for taking so long to read that, but I think it's a text upon which we can do much explicación. And I'll turn first to you, Leith. What do you make of it?
No, I think it's important that you read it. And the weight of the Israeli-Iran issue weighs heavily upon us all, vis-a-vis our policy in the region and vis-a-vis the future of the region. However, I do not subscribe to the common paradigms. Israeli-Iranian relations are far more complicated than the rhetoric would suggest. I tend to look at it in the same way that Chalmers Johnson looked at USA-USSR relations during the Cold War. You had, at that time, two global powers that were rivals with one another, but had no real interest in going to war with one another. It's the same with Israel and Iran. I would insist that there is not an imminent threat of war or of Israel attacking Iran. Israel does not want to attack Iran, nor does Iran want to attack Israel. They rather play things out in this Cold War fashion where you have these proxy battles that take out throughout the region. Now, let me demonstrate this by giving you some evidence.
You discount the rhetoric that you get from Ahmadinejad and from...
This is for domestic consumption, and the Israelis
know that. Well, but the world hears an awful lot of it. Threats to expunge that nation and get, essentially, kill off the Zionist entity. And, for that matter, the strong advice or urging by Ahmadinejad that the Jews should go back where they came from, to Poland.
In the 1980s, the rhetoric coming out of the Iranian leadership was far more harsh regarding Israel. Yet you had high-level Israeli diplomats lobbying on behalf of Iran's cause in Washington in the 1980s so that the United States would give Iran weapons in its war against Iraq. When the Reagan administration responded by saying, "Are you nuts? Have you heard some of the things coming out of Tehran?" They responded quite confidently by saying, "Look, this is all for domestic consumption." When it comes to the region, Israel and Iran, at times, interests align. At times, they have common enemies, and they're not interested.
Are you suggesting that secretly behind all the paraphernalia of the propaganda wars, that they still have common interests and they are still somehow operating in concert?
Well, I wouldn't put it that way insofar as that sounds somewhat conspiratorial, but I think that rationality, reason, and interests do govern Israeli policy and Iranian policy. Both of them are the regional powers. Between them, they have a rivalry and competition over influence. However, they do not have an interest in going to war with one another.
Then, when Krauthammer starts his column, which I just read, with the statement, either Israel is engaged in the most elaborate ruse since the Trojan horse, or it is on the cusp of a preemptive strike on Iran's nuclear facilities. What you're saying, in effect, is, yes, they are engaged in a great and elaborate ruse.
They've been promising to bomb Iran for the last 6 years, yearly, and they haven't done it.
Well, let me turn now to Charles Lipson. Do you agree?
I'm not quite sure what to make of U.S. policy, but I don't think that the Israelis are bluffing.
It is not the most elaborate ruse since the Trojan horse.
I think that the Israelis really, really, really don't want to go this alone. And I also think they don't want to be in the position of setting off what could be a regional conflagration by doing this on their own without support. But I do think that there was a lot of wisdom in that column. I've never supported the idea of a preemptive strike. I've been agnostic about it, but I haven't supported it. But I do think that the United States policy has been wobbly, and because it's been wobbly, I think that the threat that President Obama has made quite explicitly that we would go to war if necessary has not been credible in Tehran.
Let me lay on a few more facts in today's news just before we pause for a commercial, then pick up in response to this as well. We have stories today that Iran has announced through various high functionaries that that it will treat any attack upon itself as an attack by both Israel and the United States, that it will retaliate not only against the attacker directly, Israel, but against the United States, American bases, et cetera, et cetera. Also, there's a rumor story, which Al Jazeera has picked up on today, that there have been negotiations between the United States and Iran, reassuring Iran that we will not join with Israel in any such attack, but trying then to persuade them not to undertake a counterstrike, or rather a preemptive strike, to prevent a first strike by Israel. It's sort of seething. It rather reminds you of maybe just the game of bluff and counterbluff that we played during the Cold War with major nuclear forces, but it feels very tense.
Well, I look forward to commenting on this.
What follows that will be revealed directly after we pause for these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
When last we heard from Charles Lipson, he uttered the contemplative single syllable, well. Please proceed.
So what is the topic you want to talk about, Milt?
Well, our further reactions to the Krautheimer piece and what really is going on behind the scenes.
Let me take the audience back to one of the great mistakes of U.S. foreign policy, which was in 1950. The Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, gave a very prominent speech in which he outlined the defense perimeter for the United States, and he talked about how important Japan was and so forth. And he did not include South Korea. The North Koreans viewed this as a green light for an invasion. They had been talking to Stalin for a long time, trying to get Soviet backing for that invasion. When the invasion actually occurred in late June of 1950, the United States immediately, with hardly a second thought, immediately came in and said, this is unacceptable. And we entered what then became the Korean War. So it was the worst of all worlds. We did not signal clearly to the North Koreans that this would be unacceptable. And not, it has to be both clear and credible. Credible means believable by the other guys. So North Korea had to know we were going to come back at them, and we really meant it. We weren't just joking about it or playing a devil's advocate. And the result, and that's, I think, the problem that we're facing here. Of the points that Krauthammer made, one was, which was building on Cordesman, you need to have clear lines. In the case of Korea, it would be there can be some shooting across the border. There had been up to there, but no invasion. We won't let you change that border. And then it has to be credible. Now, the U.S., in defense of the U.S., you could say we've been sending a lot of carriers to the Gulf. We've been putting a lot of resources in there. We're trying, in one sense, to signal. But I would say we're also putting a huge amount of pressure on the Israelis as well. And I think that this three-point plan, which is red lines, the problem is that red lines, credible threat, and a face-saving way out for Iran. I think, however, Iran won't take anything unless they actually think their regime is in jeopardy.
A pertinent interruption.
Right.
Do you, with all of that said, estimate that unless something like the quarters of a plan is rapidly put into action, which I think is unlikely, that Israel, in all likelihood, will deliver the attacks that it's been threatening for some time?
I'd tell you it's 60 or 70% likelihood.
And what kind of attack would that then be, just in terms of the ordnance?
It would be a more targeted attack. If the U.S. decided to go in, we would take out their we would do it in the standard U.S. way. We would take out all their air defense. That would be a several-day operation, maybe a week.
You'd hit the weapons and you'd hit command and control at the same time.
Exactly. And then you go after the weapons. But you first get complete dominance of the air. And then you go after the key sites. The Israelis couldn't do that. They just don't have. This is a long way. Israel has built an air force to defend its native territory. They now have got some distance.
Can you conceive that if they were to undertake such an attack, they would do it with their own nuclear weapons?
No. I do not think that's out of the Israeli. There has been talk of a nuclear weapon, but the talk that has been, and I think it's a bad idea to even begin to talk about it, but the only talk has been that a high-level explosion could set off an electromagnetic pulse that would, in effect, fry all of the computer systems that run the electricity and everything else in Iran. But I think that the last thing that the Israelis want to do is begin the use of nuclear weapons.
We assisted them, or we assisted them, or they assisted us in another way of bollocksing up essentially the whole computer network of Iran for
I'm just glad we're admitting that Israel has nuclear weapons.
Israel's position on that, I think, has been exactly the correct one, which is they want leaders in other countries to know that they have retaliatory capacity. But if you wave it around, you just create a red flag in which others feel humiliated and have to respond by creating their own. I think that in the case of the Stuxnet, the idea that the Obama administration, for its own political gain, would leak that is just scandalous. It's awful. It really is awful.
But what they leaked was true.
I don't know, have any independent way of knowing it. They have said it. Nobody has denied it. Yeah. But they've gone out and said the U.S. and Israel has done this. It's just scandalous.
Let me turn now back to Laith. You've heard what Charles has to say. Just your response, General.
Okay, I need to respond to two things, two elements. A, the analogy, with all due respect, doesn't hold up. The relationship between Israel and Iran and the context is not the same as the relationship between North Korea and South Korea. Iran has never made any statements vis-a-vis policy that has any interest in striking Israel, has no interest in attacking Israel. All of the rhetoric surrounding attacking Israel has been defensive in posture. Should they be stricken, then they will strike back. So the analogy doesn't quite hold up. Second of all, if indeed the Israelis have an interest in seeing the regime in Iran weakened, or if we in the United States have an interest in seeing the regime in Iran weakened for a number of reasons, but perhaps the most important reason being we believe in the West that this theocratic regime has a certain view of the world that's incompatible with the modern world. Nothing would strengthen the regime more than a preemptive strike on Iran. It's a nationalist issue, and it's a popular issue. And as my respected colleague just mentioned, the fact that the Israelis possess nuclear weapons has sparked somewhat of an arms race in the region. I have no idea as what if the Iranians sincerely want to pursue nuclear weapons or sincerely want to pursue a peaceful power plant or energy
program. All the relevant Western observers who've been in there one way or another have essentially concluded, yes, they are in a march towards nuclearization.
Either way.
Not merely for energy, but for weapons.
Either way, you're in not a country, sure that they're trying to pursue a nuclear weapon?
No, I'm not. No, I could not say for certain that they have an interest in pursuing weapons. They have plenty of chemical and biological weapons. If they want to wreak havoc on the region, they could. So I even find the discussion of nuclear weapons to be the primacy that is given to be somewhat of a moot point. But that being said, and with all due respect to the possible destruction of nuclear weapons, in a country that holds elections, which Iran does, rhetorically speaking, it's a popular issue to maintain the independence and the sovereignty of their nuclear program. So it's understood. It's something that we can calculate and understand as to why they would continue to insist on their nuclear program, which they
so on the basis of what you've just been saying, where I asked Charles, what's your estimate of the likelihood that Israel will finally deliver an attack? He said it's about 60%. I guess you're suggesting it's much lower than that.
Yes, I'd say 10 to 20%.
10 to 20%. And one thing that is absolutely certain is that at this moment we pause for an update on the news. We'll return to this issue, but also a general tour of the horizon with regard to many other aspects of contemporary Middle Eastern conflict and confusion. Basically, we need to ask, has the Arab Spring turned into a kind of Arab winter? As we continue with Leif Al Saud and Charles Lipson, after the update on the news from Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we return to Charles Lipson and to Leif Al Saud as we do our peregrination around the Middle East, pausing at certain locations for closer analysis. I suggest now, gentlemen, we go in Israel up to the kibbutz Ayalet HaShafar. On the border, the northern border, and cross over the Sea of Galilee, I guess, and into Israeli-occupied territory, the Heights in Syria, and then on towards Damascus. What do we find there? What is that? Is it a civil war? Is it more of the same thing that we've had in the so-called Arab Spring, a rise against a dictatorial regime that should be put down, or is something else going on that we don't properly comprehend? One thing that I think needs to be understood is why both Russia, I almost said the Soviet Union, why Russia and China are standing with Bashar al-Assad against the rebellion, and why we are and our Western European allies are so strongly committed to knocking the al-Assad regime out. Your thoughts on that, Leif?
Well, when we analyze Syria, we have to put it in its proper historical context. In March of 2011, when the Arab Spring began, this was an entirely civilian movement. It was diverse in its constitution. It was peaceful in its makeup and insisted on remaining peaceful.
You mean the movement as it first manifested in Tunisia?
Well, sure, as it first manifested in Tunisia, but specifically in Syria as well. It was consistent with the rest of the Arab world, in which you saw a rise of civic consciousness and a sense of invested citizenship, in which people wanted to see the removal of a dictatorial regime. The Syrian regime responded, obviously, and this is well documented, with a great brutality and has continued to do so over the last
year. His father managed to kill off 50,000 who were in some degree of opposition to the regime.
Sure.
He poisoned gassed them to the extent of some 50,000 or more
in
the north.
What happened in Hama is well known. But so it is to answer your first question, is what's happening in Syria part of the Arab Spring, or is it in civil war? I would argue this. It is indeed part of the Arab Spring. And how do I define the Arab Spring? I define it as an awakening of civic consciousness. And now the question is, that doesn't necessarily mean it's not in civil war, though. So is Syria in civil war? I would argue no. Why? Because you do not have a significant part of the population that supports the regime actively, that's taken arms.
Well, how do they manage then to maintain and to use a rather sizable and rather deadly military force?
How does the regime manage to do it?
The regime does that, yes.
Well, the question of how the regime manages to do it is quite easy to answer. They're using the Air Force against a civilian population. The bombarding Dar'a
why isn't the military force rebellious against the regime?
Well, it has been, and that's what the FSA is.
Some have gone
the Free Syrian Army. Yeah. And in fact, now they're calling upon reservists to fight people who have defected. And I would seriously doubt that many of those reservists are actually going to show up. Bashar al-Assad is a matter of time. How much destruction he wreaks on Syria in the meanwhile, though, is an open question.
I defer to Laith on his understanding of the domestic politics, but I have a somewhat different interpretation as I see it. I certainly agree that the early part of the uprising was a civilian kind of – it was very much like other parts of the Arab Spring. But it's important to understand that this is a regime that, like several other dictatorial regimes in the region, had been run by a minority group. Some, like Egypt, are simply run by the military. Yeah. The Turkish regime for a long time run by the military as well. But in the case of Iraq, and in where you had a Sunni minority that was ruling with an iron fist, you had, in this case, an Alawite minority. And
it should be made clear, the Alawites are a branching off from Shiite Islam, but with some very unusual ideas and theology.
Right, and most Shia view them as apostate.
They do indeed.
Right.
Yeah.
And
deny that they are Muslim at all.
Yes, because some of their doctrines are really quite different from other Muslims. They are,
and one of the central figures in their pantheon turns out to be Mary, the mother of Jesus. Did you know that?
No, Muslims generally speaking revere.
Well, she's in the Quran, of course. Yes.
In fact, more than she is in the Bible.
Yeah.
The Alawites are based in the area of Syria and have sort of mountainous territory and so forth. It's also important to recognize that Syria, like other countries in the region, is really a cobbled-together state. One of the issues I would like to talk about with Laith is how much we expect countries like Libya to really hold together as a state, or whether we expect them to, in some sense, decompose. We had a lot of this discussion about Iraq. I think what's happened is, as the Alawite core of the military and political regime there has used more and more force, the civilians who were kind of peacefully demonstrating have been forced out of the streets. And what you're getting is a variety of militias, many with their own agendas. They coalesce and fail to coalesce in ways we don't fully understand. And now what we're getting is just a kind of something like a Hobbesian war of all against one
now,
right now.
Let me reinstate a question I posed already, and it's a crucial part of the picture, but we haven't yet addressed it, namely the Russians and the Chinese. Why are they so strongly supporting the al-Assad regime?
Well, there's two theories. One theory is that they're posturing. They want to insist on being respected in the international community, or the so-called international community. They've taken the position that they are going to oppose United States policy so that they act as some sort of balance. That's one theory. Another theory is that they support Syria because they have intimate ties with the Syrian regime in terms of selling weapons and arms, so on and so forth. In fact, the Russians even have a small naval base there or something. So they want to maintain those friendly ties, and they don't want to see it turn into a regime that is not as sympathetic with the Russians. And the truth could be it's a mixture of the two. However,
if I were in the Kremlin, I would whisper in the ears of somebody, but it's a losing game.
It is
Al-Assad won't last.
Yeah, it is a losing
game. The regime is going down.
And trying to figure out what exactly is the long-term strategy of the Russians is pretty difficult when you want to apply reason to this problem.
The major outside player, of course, is Iran.
Absolutely.
And Iran has a very strong stake. And what we understand now is that they are sending in Revolutionary Guards, and that they are also training the fighters in. So, given the pressure,
I agree with you. They are.
Given the pressure that Iran itself is under, the fact that they are spending a lot of time and effort. Why are they doing it? First, because Syria is their only ally and their main outreach to the Arab world. It's important to remind all listeners that that Iran is, or Persia, is not Arab, right? So this has been, and it's also a pass-through area to Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, which is in effect its own state. It's got a separate state in effect there. But
it's a state that was mounted and is fully supported by Iran.
Exactly. And those weapons are coming through and have come through Damascus. And in fact, Nasrallah and other key figures are based in Damascus. So we have and we've also found out in the last few weeks that Iraq, which has close ties at the senior level, is allowing a pass-through so that this regime, which I must say the current administration did nothing to prevent rising to power, that is, when the government was being put together in Iraq, the administration essentially was AWOL, and we ended up with a regime in Iraq that has played very close with Iran on some of these, and is now a pass-through to Syria. So I see real problems here. I really do. China, I think, does not have a big stake in this. Russia is playing. I think you've got it exactly right, Leith. Russia has two potential allies in the region, Iran and Syria. It doesn't want to let them go because it wants to be a big player, because it sells products to the region, and because Syria gives it a base on the Mediterranean potentially. But I think it's a losing hand.
Sure. I actually agree with Charles when he says that we have a regime in Iraq that has allied itself with both Iran and Syria. In fact, I would actually go further with him and argue that when we say Syria is the only real ally of Iran, no, they actually have a very strong ally in Iraq. However, I have to disagree. When we talk about the players who are now there in Iraqi politics, these are the same players that the Bush administration imported into Iraq in 2003 when they came in. Nouri al-Maliki belongs to the same party as Ibrahim al-Jafari, who rose to prime minister while the Bush administration was here. So we facilitated, through the invasion of Iraq, an ally with Iran in Iraq.
It must be made very clear that the Iraqi regime is essentially Shiite in composition, and that's what binds them very closely to Iran.
Well, what binds them closely to Iran is that many of the ideologues who are now ruling Iraq,
yeah,
who come from Hizb ad-Dawah, for example, which translates as to the party of the call, and it's essentially a Shiite theocratic party, spent their years in exile in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Spent 20, 30 years in Iran. They were patronized by the Iranians. So they feel that they owe the Iranians a great deal of loyalty. And not only that, they had been schooled in Iran. They had adopted themselves many of the Iranian political motifs that were, on the whole, alien to Iraqi society. I mean, just as Charles mentioned, the Iranians have their own traditions. They have their own languages. They have their own culture. In Iraq is distinctly Arab and has its own traditions.
We are about to pause for the usual reasons, but what you're saying now reminds me of a matter I certainly want to get to. We're told that we pacified Iraq. Iraq is a success. It doesn't look like a success to me at all.
It's an absolute failure.
From the point of view of American policy.
Or humanitarian point of view.
And well, in terms of humanitarian considerations, the fact is they keep killing one another. That is, the Sunnis kill the Shiites kill the Sunnis, and they blow up groups of pilgrims, and they blow up mosques. It's all really quite dreadful, and one wonders, when there's full disengagement by American forces, won't that just let loose 1,000 additional devils? I know that you've written a good deal about Iraq, and I know that you're a native-born Iraqi, though you got here before you were just about 1 year old.
Mm-hmm.
But when we return,
sure,
let's zero in a little bit more on Iraq itself and whether there is any prospect of a stable, more or less democratic regime emerging and lasting for a few decades. Directly back to Leith Al-Saud and Charles Lipson after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we return to Charles Lipson, a professor of political science at the University of Chicago, and to Leith Al-Saud, who is Do you count as professor or instructor these days at DePaul?
I'm a visiting assistant professor.
That's good.
That is my official title.
You're moving up the hierarchy. That's great. Visiting assistant professor in Islamic world studies at DePaul University, even as you're completing your doctorate at the University of Chicago.
Yes.
Iraq is your native land, though basically you've been raised, of course, in the United States, but you've got loads of contacts back there and relatives and so on. Can that, considering there's been a lot of blood, a lot of trouble, even we lost a considerable number of people, but possibly hundreds of thousands of Iraqis have more or less been sacrificed in this time of trouble.
Estimated up to a million, perhaps.
Yeah. Is it conceivable that something stable will emerge? Or is it already stable except for trouble on the periphery?
No, it's not stable at all, but I want to address a few very important things that have
been brought up
over the course of the last few minutes. And we can actually extend this analysis to Syria as well. I think within the Western nomenclature, when we talk about the Middle East, this whole business of Sunni and Shia has become very prominent and pervasive. And we misanalyze the region when we invest too much into the Sunni and Shia business. So on a personal level, for example, my mother's Shia, my dad is Sunni. In Iraq, 75% of the population had lived in four major cities. And those four major cities, integration, marriage between Sunnis and Shiites, Kurds and Arabs, was actually very high. At least one-third of Iraqis had a mixed marriage, if you will, between Sunnis or Shiites or Kurds and Arabs. If you look at the way that Kurds voted in Baghdad, as well as the way Shiites voted in Baghdad, a cosmopolitan city with deep history, and a cosmopolitan history at that, dating back to the 8th century, you will find that they tended to vote for Ayad Alawi, the secular candidate who emphasized a secular Iraqi national identity, a geographic-based national identity. Now, when we talk about Syria, and once again we talked about, and if I may quote you, the Sunnis and the Shiites are killing each other, it doesn't happen in my house, and it doesn't happen in my family, and it doesn't happen with Iraqis that I know, and it doesn't happen with Syrians that I know. We have done the same poor analysis with Syria or Iraq as we did in Afghanistan. When we went into Afghanistan, we couldn't understand why all these tribal leaders would not remain loyal to the American ambitions in the region. And they figured that, well, these guys just aren't loyal. But that's not really quite the case. When you're a tribal leader, you have to look out for the interests of your tribe. That's how you think. And whoever's going to make your tribe the better deal, you're going to take that deal. So what's happening with the Alawis in Syria is not because they're Alawis and the majority of the country is Sunni. It's because the Alawis still remain highly tribal in their structure. And therefore, you have tribal leaders who feel that this is the best investment for their tribe. It's not a sectarian issue. It's not a theological issue. It's raw, at times, tribal politics or geographic politics.
I think that's very helpful, and I think it's important to understand. But it's also important to understand that political leaders on the ground take those existing fissures and try to use them as wedges. So when we see the old loyalists to Saddam Hussein bombing Shia pilgrimages and that sort of thing, what they're trying to do is take these wedges, which are potentially there, and make it impossible for them to live. We saw this in the Balkans. It was precisely because we had a lot of intermarriage. We had people living close together and so forth. That when you saw hard nationalist movements among Croatians, among Serbians, all of the different contending groups, it forced apart these groups that had until then been living relatively peacefully. So the implication of what you were saying is that because people had been living peacefully, strategic malefactors who are trying to drive these wedges won't succeed. Are you really saying that?
Well, let me agree with you and when you say that political leaders will take advantage of perceived divisions in a society. However, to whom does this advantage really lie? Many would argue, if you look at Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, who also remains the Minister of the Interior, who also remains the Defense Minister of Iraq, so he's quite authoritarian, he actually gains more through Iraqi insecurity than would be the supposedly Sunni population that's under siege, because It creates the sense that the Shi'i population is under attack, and therefore they need a strong Shi'i leader to protect them. So I don't know who's behind the violence in Iraq. Nobody does. But many people point their fingers actually back at Maliki or even to Iran as a source of the instability, much in the same cases that people point to Syria and the regime and Bashar.
Going back to Milt's initial question, and it was really the point I was pushing, there was really a chance we could have backed Alawi and a more secular group, and they would have had affiliations, I think, with the Kurds from the north and some others. And we sort of played a hands-off game, and the result is that we got a much more theological group in there led by Nouri al-Maliki. They've been much closer to Iran for the reasons that you mentioned, and I think it was a missed opportunity for the United States. It was just maladroit policy. We did a lot of maladroit policy. Remember, there was an uprising in Iran, and the United States refused to back it because basically President Obama's policy at the time was he thought we could do a deal with Iran. We still thought well into the uprising in Syria that that Assad was potentially a reformer. This was just lunacy, but it was very, very consequential bad policy.
All I can say is that the invasion of Iraq was doomed to fail from the very beginning. The idea that we were going to go into Iraq and rebuild Iraq as we had ambitions to rebuild the Middle East into a place where McDonald's would be available and plenty of Britney Spears albums would be available was very ignorant and very arrogant, quite frankly, on the part of people who thought that.
Well, I suppose you can't get a McDonald's hamburger by now in Baghdad, can you?
Well, if you're not afraid to step out in the street and God forbid a bomb go off or a stray bullet come flying your way. I mean, Iraq is a place where you have one major bombing a month. And by major bombing a month, I'm talking about 100, 150 sure. people dying. Yeah. And that's lasted at least for the last year. You're talking about a country where you have 2 million people displaced within the country. You have over a million refugees outside of the country. And in terms of corruption, Iraq constantly ranks the lowest in the world, meaning there's more corruption in Iraq than there are in other places. It's considered one of the worst places to live next to Somalia and Afghanistan. So when you have a country with so much tremendous wealth and human capital, there was a thriving middle class in Iraq of well-educated people. There were women graduating from law school in Iraq in the 1920s. So Iraq has certainly regressed over the last 30 years, much of that due to the boneheaded policies of Saddam Hussein when he provoked a war with Iran and then later with Kuwait, and then due to our incompetent policies.
Well, you speak of Iraq regressing, and we've talked now and again about religion, whether Sunni Shia or Alawite or what have you. We haven't even mentioned the Sufis, who are a very interesting special movement. But one thing that we haven't directly adverted to in this conversation, I raise it now, you'll recognize it instantly as a major theme, is the regressive or retrogressive quality of a fundamentalist Islam, of Islamic Jihad, of Wahhabism, of Salafism, of Al-Qaeda itself in the theology that sustains Al-Qaeda. And in the West, there are many who say, who think that's Islam, and that's all of Islam, and that damns the Middle East as an impossible place because religious fanaticism has taken over, and it's anti-Western, it's anti-democratic, it's, of course, anti-Jewish, and we had better just recognize that this is an enemy that must be vanquished one way or another. And we that dimensionality isn't shared by all, but there's a strong feeling in the West, varying perhaps from country to country, and within the countries varying from one to another political group. But still, it's a major trend in Western reactivity these days, and has been for some time, that Islam is dangerous. And the dangerous aspects of Islam are now being nurtured and now are rising in the Arab world generally, or the Middle Eastern world generally, and that's what the so-called Arab Spring is really about. It really is an Arab winter because it's bringing that plague down upon those nations and upon the Western nations that have to deal with them. I'm not saying that I believe all of that. I'm trying to characterize one main strain of Western thought. And I wonder how the two of you respond. I wonder what you say about the degree to which there's some realism in that condemnation. And I'll persist with that, of course, when we return after the update on the evening's news from Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg from the Allstate Studios in Chicago on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Charles Lipson and to Laith Al-Saud. I won't try to repeat the purple passage that I was engaged in before the news, but simply raise this question. There are many who are convinced, and some of them have been guests on this program, and some of them are people with scholarly credentials or strong journalistic credentials, and to be sure they tend to be on the conservative side, who are convinced that Islam is a danger to the West, that it is taking over in a good portion of Western Europe, and because of demographic factors may begin to dominate in Western Europe, some of the countries at least, and that it is inimical to democracy because it is inimical to the standards that we have inherited through the long history of Christian civilization and the long history of Western secularism. That Islamic fundamentalism is a religion which also has political meaning and political ambitions, and no good will come out of the Middle East, and all of those so-called revolutions or those civic rebellions in the so-called Arab Spring are really misunderstood by those who don't recognize the persisting and growing menace. I've got a little purplish in conveying all of that, but that's really there. What do you make of it, and do you in some sense credit that there's something to it? I ask first of Laith Al-Saud.
Well, first, when we talk about Islam being a threat to the West, I mean, we almost talk about it as if Islam has legs and two arms and is running around the world and actually doing things. We don't say, is Christianity a threat to the East? Or we don't say, is Judaism a threat to Europe? We tend to not talk that way.
But Islam is moving into the West.
But if you're...
Demographically...
Again, are you saying Muslims are moving into the West?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So let me set that important question aside for a moment and talk about the nature of these revolutions.
Mm-hmm.
All right. These revolutions reflect the diversity of Middle Eastern society. And we have a tendency to want to reduce the Middle East, which is an incredibly diverse place. It's a place of Muslims, Christians, and Jews. It's a place of Arabs, Kurds, Turks, Hebrews, Berbers, and on the list goes. It's an innumerable list. And we have a tendency to...
The Druze are fascinating.
There's another group who are also Arabs, though, however.
Yeah.
So we have a tendency to want to reduce the Middle East and collapse its spectrum of diversity to something that's easily manageable and digestible for our quick bite media. But we can't do that. What we're seeing on the streets of Cairo, for example, and I've been to Cairo twice in the past 2 years. I was there during the revolution in February of 2011. I was there again this past summer during the elections in which Mohamed Morsi was elected president of Egypt in the first free elections Egypt has ever had, at least that Egypt has ever had. So what did I see in the streets of Cairo? I saw diversity. I saw a small percentage of the population that could be described as you would have described them perhaps as fundamentalists or Puritan or whatever the case may be. However, the percentage of those Muslims vis-a-vis the larger population of Egypt, I would argue, is smaller than the percentage of evangelicals in our own country that are insisting that they have a political role.
Is not the Muslim Brotherhood, which now controls the government, essentially a fundamentalist movement?
Well, it depends on what you mean by fundamentalist, but my immediate response or my instinctive response would be absolutely not.
Really?
If by fundamentalist you mean something that's not moderate, then my answer would be absolutely not. The Muslim Brotherhood is incredibly moderate, pragmatic. We see work by political scientists like Michelle Browers, who analyze the way that they have compromised in a pragmatic program with secularists, with people on the left, with people in labor. They've been involved in Egyptian politics for a very, very long time, and they're very wise and they're very prudent as to what's necessary to rebuild a country. The cultural rhetoric that would emphasize what kind of clothes a woman would wear or how long a guy's beard is not going to fly in Egypt. It's a smart population. It's a population that gets by on its wits. They want to see development. They want to see education. They want to see jobs. They want to see all the same things that everybody else across the world wants to see. So if they want to argue a cultural program, and I did an interview with some members of the Muslim Brotherhood last year. If they want to advocate a cultural program, in the same way that we find some people here in the United States who want to advocate a cultural program above and beyond social programs, they're going to fail. And that's the true test of a democracy. The benefit of democracy is that it brings some accountability. With some accountability, hopefully comes some prosperity. So they're going to be held to account for their
The true policies. Test of a democracy in that case will be whether or not they relinquish power and allow free and fair elections and allow others to organize in groups against them. With all due respect, I find it offensive to liken evangelical Christians and radical Islam, and I'm not an evangelical Christian. I just find that it's worse than a stretch. It's deeply misleading. I would differentiate two parts of your question, Milt. One is the issue of a Muslim population that has fled these failed governments and failed economies and is now living in Europe, which has failed to reproduce its native populations and therefore is importing workers and has a low internal birth rate, but these immigrant groups have large birth rates, so there's a shifting demographics within Europe.
It is, for example, predicted that Italy, particularly, right. will be a Muslim-majority nation by the middle of this century.
It's funny. I was having dinner with a friend of mine's daughter last week, and she had a friend with her who lives in Florence, Italy, and is in her late 20s and now has her own apartment. And I was asking about how many Italians live with their mothers, and she said essentially everybody does, and that she's looked down upon for having her own apartment and being kind of independent and on her own as a single woman. But and this would be true for single men as well. The men live at home, and of course they don't have children until they form family units, which they don't do until their 30s. So they're well below replacement population rates in places. But they
the average number of children in Italian families is 1.2.
One of the things that makes it hard for Americans, I think, to understand what's going on is that we're not a nation state. There's not a sense in the United States, as there is in Germany, that there is something called a German, or in Poland that there's something called a Pole. Jews who had lived in Poland for hundreds of years were still thought of as Jews. They weren't thought of as Poles. In England, you know, or look, there was the United Kingdom, but people still thought of themselves as Scottish. And in fact, they're breaking off. And what do you do? We're finding, especially in Northern Europe, where I've talked to a number of people there, the normal assumption was you just didn't move to Denmark unless you wanted to become Danish. You wanted to learn the language. You want to live like Danes. And so they didn't pay any attention as long as you paid your taxes and sort of didn't break the law. But they're now discovering that this is not actually leading to integrations of groups that don't want to actually integrate. That's not been such a problem in the United States precisely because we're not a nation state. There's no sense in which you, having moved here at age one with immigrant parents, are less of an American than me, who's been here for three or four generations. One of my college roommates' family came over on the Mayflower. I'm no less an American than him, and you're no less an American than him, Leif. So that's really different. Plus, we have a very open job market and that's one way in which people get to know each other. And our school system is segregated by income and area, but people get to know each other in jobs and so forth. That's not true in France. Muslim immigrants are living in banlieues outside of the city and not integrating. I would differentiate all those problems, and you've had Mark Stein and a number of other important figures talk about these issues. One of the most interesting is actually Bruce Bauer. I don't know if you've had him, but he's a gay man.
I've read him. He lives in Denmark, I think, or Norway.
He had moved actually from Amsterdam to one of the
to get away from the
yes because
the
he was finding actually that as a gay man there was a lot of antagonism to him and his partner. So this is also something that was thought to be a kind of settled issue and has now been reopened. I would differentiate all of that from the issues that Leif was talking about the political environment of the Middle East itself.
Well, I'm a little confused because we were talking about the nature of the Arab Spring and now we're talking about American national identity. And I can't let this go.
Right.
With all due respect to my esteemed colleague, but Charles accused me of being misleading when I compared evangelical Christians with certain Islamists. Now, the first problem I have with that characterization is that I was talking about the Muslim Brotherhood, and once again, he reduced the Muslim Brotherhood to radical Islamists. However, they're not radical Islamists. They are moderate. They're pragmatists. Yet, they are motivated by certain cultural and religious values, much like evangelicals in the United
was
States.
Was not Saeed Qutb, on whom you've done
yes,
work,
absolutely.
Wasn't he surely Islamist and fundamentalist, and wasn't he really one of the founders, or provided the theology and the ideology upon which the Muslim Brotherhood was reared?
No, actually, it's the contrary to that. Saeed Qutb, who was a chief ideologue of the Muslim Brotherhood and was executed by the government of Jamal Abdel Nasser in 1966 in Egypt. Saeed Qutb began by advocating for greater social equity on the basis of Islamic values. And in fact, contemporary scholars like Hassan Hanafi call him the start of what we describe as an Islamic left, people who argued for greater social equity. Now, when Qutb began to espouse more radical ideas, it was after his 10-year stint in prison, in which he was severely tortured. He came out, he advocated more radical ideas. The Muslim Brotherhood today disavows Saeed Qutb and has done so for the last 3 or 4 decades.
We are about to pause for some commercials that are overdue. I have got a last question I want the two of you to address when we come back. And then after the 10:30 news break, we will be going to the phones. So we'll open the lines right now. The number, of course, is 312-591-7200. For anything we've talked about with regard to Middle Eastern politics and religion, or anything we haven't talked about but should address and that you want to call to our attention, 312-591-7200. The last thing I hope we can address in just a few minutes is the future of Israel in that Arab-Muslim world. We talked about Israel in relation to Iran. We haven't talked about the question of whether, finally, the rest of the Middle East can settle for the fact that there is a presence there. It's a presence which could be advantageous if a true peace were finally made. And so I say, maybe they don't say that. But let's talk about that just a bit after we pause for this.
This is Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Leif Al-Saud and to Charles Lipson. In a while, on to your calls. The lines are now open. Any question or comment you want to make, get in there quickly. 312-591-7200. 312-591-7200. If you want to join in this conversation, either with question or with comment, now's the time to make your move. Basically, what about the future of Israel in relation to the Arab nations and to the Islamic fundamentalism, which animates a fair amount of the politics of some, if not all, of those Arab nations? Is there a future for Israel? Will the peace finally really be achieved? Should it be achieved?
Well, two things. A, we have to keep in mind that a great deal of Jewish fundamentalism possibly animates Israeli politics as well. And that Netanyahu has had to deal with.
By that you mean the settler movement and so on.
Sure, things like that. However, let me say something that's not common, and I don't think said often enough about Israel. Israel is, in my mind, its own worst enemy. It's facing a demographic problem that if it does not deal with by 2030, it's going to lose its status as a democratic nation. It's going to have to severely repress large segments of its population that it has control over.
You're talking about demographic shifts?
Yes.
There will be more Muslims than Jews living in Israel.
Once again, it's important to distinguish. There will be more Arabs than Jews living in Israel over the next 2, 3, or 4 decades.
Yeah.
And if the Israelis are not able to find a way to reconcile themselves with this native population that in at least 20% of the Israeli population live within its own borders.
Israel pre-1967, or you're talking about the present sphere of Israeli dominance even in the West Bank. Are you saying if you go back to a real settlement and a two-nation solution, a two-state solution, still historic Israel would become essentially an Arab majority?
1 in 5 Israelis, people who hold Israeli passports, are Arabs.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, so that's 20% of the population right there. However, Israel, through settlements, exercises a great deal of political control over the West Bank.
Yeah, of course.
And the West Bank is very much part of the Israeli landscape. I mean that both figuratively
and literally. But if you get a two-state solution, the West Bank will become a part of the Arab state, obviously.
Are you asking me about the viability of the two-state solution? Because it's quickly not becoming viable.
Ah. I didn't know you felt that way. Explain why.
Well, because there's no state for the Palestinians. The West Bank is getting carved up between various settlements in which roads divide various lands between Palestinian communities to connect these settlements together. The Gaza Strip is literally uninhabitable. It's squalor. It's stricken by poverty, a poor infrastructure, and it has also a booming population. So if you want to talk about a viable Palestinian state, I don't see one.
Well, if Israel got out of the West Bank completely, that would give you the basis for a viable Palestinian
state. Well, it would
certainly
re-spark the conversation of its viability.
It's a very deep problem for some of the reasons that Leif said. I also see the problem increasing because of the cleavage between Gaza and the West Bank, a social cleavage as well. I mean, you talk to people from Gaza, they have almost no contact with the West Bank. They view themselves, although they both view themselves as Palestinian, they really do view themselves as quite different. And so one possibility will be that there will be a three-state solution, actually, that there won't be – that it will be like Pakistan that was originally thought of as one state and then Bangladesh becomes separate from Pakistan. But Israel – going back to Israel in its own right, Israel for a long time was essentially safe because once it had won a series of big wars ending in 73, leading to the peace overtures from Egypt, recognizing that Egypt under Sadat could not – didn't see any military victory in the future – that meant that Syria, though it didn't make peace, couldn't make war on its own. So Israel was fundamentally secure. That then changed with uprisings in the West Bank, the Intifada. And now Israel essentially faces a series of problems. One is the problem of the West Bank in Gaza, that is a Palestinian population that does not view itself as wanting to be part of Israel. Israel doesn't want to rule over these. That was the actual lesson of the first Intifada, that Israel recognized that it could not rule over this alien population without essentially damaging itself as both a democracy and as a Jewish state. The problem is Israel has nobody to make peace with. In the absence of people who actually want to make peace and who will be able to deliver it on their side, the Israelis have taken more unilateral action. That leads to a kind of spiral of the sort that Leith has talked about. That makes it increasingly hard for any Palestinians to actually rise up as peaceful leaders.
Time is short, but I really want to put this directly and strongly to Leith. What then is the way out? What? How do we get from here to there? There being somehow finally a settlement of the outstanding issues, persistence of an Israeli Jewish majority state, and a flourishing future for the surrounding Arab states?
Well, that's a big question to lay on my plate with such little time. What is the way out, or what? In fact, let me put it this way. What is the solution to the Arab-Israeli crisis? And I think the solution lies within Israel itself. Israel needs to begin to reorientate itself vis-a-vis the region. They need to see themselves as part of the region rather than as a Western outpost in the region. For many of the Arabs who surround Israel, the rhetoric they hear coming out of Israel, or even the cultural insistences they see coming out of Israel, have colonial resonances to them. Israel is still seen as part of the colonial legacy. in some ways.
I think you're at the point of saying Israel has to give up the aspiration to remain a Jewish majority state. It has to view itself as a mixed state with possibly even Arab majority, but still full tolerance of and indulgence of Judaism and of Jewish culture, but no longer a Jewish state.
Well, I'm very uncomfortable talking about a Jewish state or a Muslim state or a Christian state or a Buddhist state.
Well, Israelis are not uncomfortable.
Yeah, I understand that, but I myself am. So you would have to ask somebody who wants to insist on maintaining this Jewish state. For me, I prefer to see civic states that have civic identities in which people have a commonality in the law. I like the American experience. I agree with Charles wholeheartedly when he looks at me as an immigrant and says, you're just as American as I am, although I've been here for four generations, and he's just as American as his roommate who had ancestors on the Mayflower. I like the American model, and I want to see that particular aspect of the American model more universal.
But it's the end of Zionism. In terms of the Zionist,
that's not the Zionist
intention.
Project.
Yeah.
And they had viewed themselves as both Jewish and in its original form, essentially secular Jews.
They were socialists.
But
they
remember,
were secular
there is no organization of Christian states in the world, right? There is an organization of Islamic states. And Israel is surrounded by states, none of whom, if you ask any of the leaders, do you recognize the right of a Jewish state to exist in the region, they would all say no, and they would mean it. They wouldn't just be saying it for public consumption. They really view this as a problem, and I don't view Israel as a colonial outpost. The reason it looks more and more like the West now is that it's developing all the features that we love about the West. It's a vibrant democracy. It has vibrant technology. It has great universities. Women are incorporated in the society and all the rest.
We're not going to solve this one tonight, I fear. But it's a very interesting exposition of two quite contrasting positions. And we're about to pause for a news break and then to the phones for any question or comment you want to register. 312-591-7200. The board is open and available to you. But get in there quickly. I call upon my good friends with real questions or comments to call instantly at 312-591-7200 to the newsroom and Paula Cooper.
This is Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Now hear this. That's what they say on shipboard. The smoking lamp is lit. And we need more good telephone calls. Get in there instantly if you've got anything to say or to ask. 312-591-7200. I'd be most pleased if we had calls not merely from Americans, but indeed from Israelis, from Arabs, from anyone who's got something of a stake in Middle Eastern life and Middle Eastern politics. But you don't have, just as you don't have to be Jewish to enjoy Levy's rye bread, famous advertising slogan, you don't have to be an Israeli or a Palestinian or an Arab to pose a question or raise a question. Pose a thought, rather, or raise a question. 312-591-7200. And we go first to John. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening. I called a couple times before when you spoke about Israel and Palestine, and I made the comment that a lot of times when there's a discussion, it's always Israel and Palestine, but it doesn't include Syria and Saudi Arabia and Jordan as part of the solution. And I was wondering if you include these countries, doesn't that pretty much solve the problem? Or
well, show how including those countries does solve the problem. What do you have in mind?
Pardon me?
Explain how that helps to solve the problem if you make mention of Saudi Arabia and Syria and Jordan. What do you have
in
mind?
There's a large population of Palestinians in Jordan, and when this conflict first started,
to be sure.
I believe that there was some talk of moving some of the Palestinians to some of these countries.
Quite so. About half of the population of Jordan, or more than half, is of Palestinian origin. That's established. So you're suggesting Palestinians ought to spread out through the rest of the Middle East?
Well, not only that, but also when there's a discussion of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, there's no inclusion of Syria or Saudi Arabia or Jordan in the discussion. I don't understand that.
Gentlemen.
One of the interesting, you're certainly right, Milt, that Jordan has a very large Palestinian population. We estimate more than half of the population. One of the features of non-democratic governments is that they don't have good census data for an obvious reason. They don't want it, right? There was no – the 20% of Iraq who were Sunnis thought they were a majority in the country because there was never any census done there. That's true. And it's also true that when people left the area of Palestine, some may have thought of themselves as Palestinian, some not, starting in 48. When they moved into other countries, they were never integrated into those countries. So they didn't become a Syrian, or they didn't become Jordanian or whatever. Families like Rashid Khalidi's family, which served for a long time as diplomats in Kuwait, never became Kuwaitis. So that's all correct. But I think that those issues have now changed their quality. You just are not going to get a situation in which people who are currently living there can be willingly moved into other countries and will accept citizenship elsewhere.
A response from Leith Al-Saud.
Well, I would just like to remind the caller that when we talk about moving populations from their native land into other places, that is known in international law as ethnic cleansing.
Well, ethnic cleansing really involves not merely moving populations, but killing populations.
No, according to international law, forcibly moving populations from their homes is a form of ethnic cleansing. When you're talking about killing those populations, that's a form of genocide.
Yeah, and John Mearsheimer has been saying for decades now that Israel would forcibly move all these people out and use some war as a cover. And the fact that Israel never does it, never tries to do it, doesn't seem to have any impact whatsoever. But on his view that they must and will eventually take that view. But of course they are not going to do it. And it may be true that people will move voluntarily to other countries in order to pursue economic opportunities. That's what we were talking about earlier with regard to Europe and people from North Africa. But that's a wholly different issue.
Gentlemen, let's go next to the next caller. That is Daniel, who joins us at WGN Radio. Good evening, sir.
Dr. Rosenberg, good evening. You know, I'm listening. I seem to recall that Arafat walked away, at least from what I took from the media and from writings. He walked away from a deal with Clinton, and I believe it was Ehud Barak at the time, which it seemed would have avoided the rise of Hamas on the West Bank and would have averted an additional, I guess, 15 years now of settlement, and he interposed at the end, from what I understand, the right of return. As long as there's this right of return business, isn't the whole thing just impossible? And isn't that at the root of it? From what I understood, the deal that was on the table that Clinton put before Arafat, both sides would have benefited. Whatever happens, no one's going to get the full realization of the Balfour Declaration. But what was on the table, I think, would have avoided the deterioration that's really taken place in the last 15 years. And I just wonder if anybody has a comment on that.
When particularly, Charles, my memory on this is a little thin. The deal that Arafat could have taken rejected by Arafat, was that Stockholm?
No, that was another attempt at Camp David, and there was
at Camp David itself, of course.
And there was additional talk at Taba afterwards. Let me give a little background for Daniel, and I'd be interested in Leif's comments if we have time. The Israelis in the aftermath the Intifada recognized that they wanted to do a deal with the Palestinians, thought they could not do a deal unless they did it with the preeminent spokesman for the Palestinians, Yasser Arafat. They had deep doubts about him. He was at that point in exile in Syria, having made a hash of both an attempt actually to take over in Jordan and to do something similar in Lebanon. But the Israelis brought him back thinking through the Oslo Accords, basically, that they could give him more and more local administrative authority. That would be a kind of political learning. They could take over police, fire, all those functions, schooling, and that this would be peace building, and that eventually that would lead to a Palestinian state. Arafat never began even the most remote elements of that. There was never an attempt to build a real police force, real fire forces, real schooling, and so forth.
Is this when Abba Ibn said of Arafat, Yasser Arafat has never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity?
He said that of the Palestinians more generally, but it was certainly true of Arafat. So my own view is that Arafat was never going to take the deal at Camp David or Taba, and it was all a ruse. He had made a decision. He wanted to be Che Guevara, this romantic leader, and also later corrupt, and not Fidel Castro.
Leif Elsad.
Well, I think it's an interesting analysis of the personal motivations of Yasser Arafat. I cannot speak to the personal motivations of Yasser Arafat. I just think we need to be cautious when we talk about Arab-Israeli relations, or in particular Israeli-Palestinian relations in the peace process. I think we have a tendency to talk about Israel as if it's a willing partner in peace, and hasn't itself at times been both reticent, stubborn, or even flat-out wrong or incoherent. So it's a two-way street, and it's persisted over the last 60, 70 years that it's difficult to make peace between these groups.
Our thanks to the caller for an interesting comment and question. And we will pause for a last quick round of commercials, then right back to the phones. 312-591-7200.
It's Extension 720 with Bill Mahler in for Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to the phones. Next up is Brian. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Hi, Milt.
Yes, sir.
I have one comment about ethnic cleansing. I think really what happened during the 1948 war is that many of the Palestinians elected to leave Palestinian territory to avoid the conflict that was coming in from all fronts, which was started by numerous Arab countries to invade Israel. They didn't want to get squeezed in between. So I think it's incorrect to blame the Israelis as the cause of that migration to Jordan. And you can correct me if I'm wrong. My question, though, is about Gaza. To me, it's very concerning about the alarming population growth there and why they do not take it among themselves to start to employ birth control, family planning, and get with the 20th century and the rest of the modern world. And I'll hang up and wait for your answer.
All right. No need to hang up. So hang in there. But let's respond.
I'll be glad to take that one in both parts. Concerning the first part, we were talking about the context of, quote-unquote, transferring Palestinians to Jordan, as the first caller, I believe, suggested or recommended or possibly observed. I don't want to put words in his mouth. And that's when I brought up the comment about, according to international law, that is known as ethnic cleansing. And it is. We are not talking about what happened in 1948. What happened in 1948 is its own thing. Now, regarding your suggestion about birth control and coming up with the 20th century, well, you have to live in conditions that are similar to the 20th century, or the 21st century, rather, if you want people to have a particular kind of health care or access to contraceptives. I find the suggestion a little strange. But it is what you suggested, and if you have a question as to why perhaps they're not using contraceptives, perhaps they're too busy trying to find food.
Are the callers gone? He's not still on the line. Further comment?
I would just say about the people who left for whatever reason in 48, and I have no doubt that some that there were a mix of motives. There were Jewish groups that were happy to see Arab populations leave and did everything they could to encourage them, sometimes violently. There were Arabs who left because people like to leave a war zone. There were Arabs who left because they thought they would win the whole territory and why not come back in triumphantly later. What's troubling is that three and four and or more generations later, anybody who left there is still considered a refugee. 11 million or so Germans were ethnically cleansed from Eastern Europe after World War II. They were simply reintegrated into Germany, and we don't hear about them anymore. Even now, the East Germans, you do hear something about that split now that they've been reintegrated. But the fact that people who've been living in regular houses or whatever, in sometimes in parts that are now occupied by Israel, sometimes in other countries, are still considered refugees. It's the only refugee population that continues to expand.
Well, my response to that is that much of the tone of the right of return was determined by the Israelis themselves. The Israelis insist that a Jewish person, regardless of how far back you go, them living either in Europe or North America, so particularly Ashkenazi Jews, have a right, or in fact, aliyah, a migration back to what they consider to be the homeland of Israel. When we're talking about three or four generations, as opposed to 40 or 50 generations, it seems like a relatively small ask from the Palestinian point of view.
But if Israel also gives up territory in, let's say, what Jews have called Judea and Samaria, then Israel wouldn't demand that Jews be able to resettle in that territory. They would say that territory is now Palestinian, and Palestinians can settle in that territory.
Well, that would be part of a settlement and a compromise vis-a-vis what was initially wanted from the Zionist project. But I also have to add to what Charles had suggested about the refugee population. Many of these refugees are not living in houses. Many of these refugees are, in fact, still living in refugee camps, whether they're in Lebanon or Syria and other places. And this is something
that's becoming mine. But the camps are not tents. A lot of the camps, I mean, these are permanent houses and the like.
Yeah, but four generations living in any kind of camp is a problem.
Well, a good deal of blame there can be leveled at the governments who have been not very good hosts, particularly in Lebanon, where they've maintained those camps for, well, since the original 48 conflict. Let's go quickly to one or two more callers. We're very short on time. And next up is Michael, who joins us here at WGN Radio. Good evening, sir.
Yeah, hello. How are you tonight?
All right. Please go ahead.
Good. Listen, I was going to ask a question about water, but I'm listening to the conversation, and I'm thinking this, to me, is the question that has to be asked. Israel was created on May 15th, 48, is that correct? Hello?
Yes, we're here. The official declaration of the state, I'm not sure that that is the date. But go ahead.
Yeah, it was in May 1948, and I can't remember the exact date.
It was May 15th.
All right, go ahead.
Okay.
On April 20th, the city of Haifa was ethnically cleansed of 60,000 Palestinians in one day.
Sir, we're very short on time, and you have to be a little bit less dramatic and more productive.
What 60,000 people on April 17th were kicked out of their homes and shipped and had to go into the Mediterranean. What should be done with their houses?
Into the Mediterranean? You're saying that they were all killed, that they were marched out into the ocean and drowned?
No, a lot of them drowned. A lot of them.
No, that's nonsense.
This is nonsense.
That is nonsense.
And the fact is,
a lot of them went to Gaza. A lot of them went to Lebanon.
Yeah, people did leave. About 700,000 people, 750 left these territories. A roughly equal number of Jews were driven out of Arab countries throughout the Middle East. Those people are now called Israelis. The people who went from these Arab lands, who often didn't think of themselves at the time as Palestinians and moved into what became other countries, were never accepted. They were rounded up into camps, not by the Jews, but by people in the surrounding Arab states, and they have been kept in camps. These refugee camps were not camps in the Jewish state. They were camps in the surrounding Arab Muslim states.
You know, it does occur to me, we've done many, many conversations here about the Middle East, and I often call it a tour of the horizon. But whatever we set out to do, inevitably you wind up with the question of Israel and the surrounding nations and the persisting problem and the absence of settlement. And I begin to fear, Charles, because you and I have been through this many times before. Laith joins us doing this for the first time. I begin to fear that we will never have a program on the Middle East that doesn't take this ending.
I fear the same. It's a full employment act for people who are international analysts, I fear. Yeah. But I want to say something about the first part of the program, Milt. I think it's important to recognize, as we talked about the problems in Iraq, the problems in Syria, the problems in Egypt, not so the problems, I would say, in Iran. All of those problems would be exactly the same if Israel didn't exist at all. So the people in the United States, which tends to see the whole Middle East through the prism of the Arab-Israeli conflict, it's worth looking at the Arab Spring and noting how little it had to do with Israel and how the outcomes, which right now look very troubling, also don't have anything to do with Israel, but rather with internal problems in that region, which would be with us even if Israel were not.
Laith, 20 seconds for a last comment.
Well, in many ways, I actually have to agree with Charles in that respect. I don't know if I could say that the region would be exactly the same with or without Israel. I have no way of knowing that hypothetical. However, I will say this. The Arab Spring had very little to do with Israel. And we have to keep in mind that the Arab world is 400 million people, whereas Israel is 6 or 7 million, and we have to place it in that perspective.
I thank you for joining us tonight, Laith Al-Saud, and as ever, a reliable old friend and frequent participant in the program, Charles Lipson of the University of Chicago Department of Political Science. We'll be doing some political science here tomorrow night, I imagine. We'll be doing commentary on the by then just concluded Democratic Convention. My guests will include Joe Morris, former Assistant Attorney General of the United States, and Richard Ciccone, former Managing Editor of the Chicago Tribune. There may be another guest as well. We'll disclose all of that tomorrow. But for now, my strong thanks to Laith Al-Saud and Charles Lipson. Thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial good night to all.